This is Caffeinated Risk, the monthly podcast for security professionals by security professionals, focused on the principles of enterprise security risk management, exploring technology and business management issues and how they relate to information security risk. Once a month, two self-proclaimed grumpy security guys bring you analysis, insights, and interviews with leading security risk professionals to learn how they work through a project, a program, or their careers using a risk-based approach to security. Now, here are your hosts, Tim McCreet and Doug Leese.
Welcome, everyone, to our first podcast for Caffeinated Risk. My name is Tim McCreet, and my partner is Doug Leese. We're happy to have you here for the very first of many, we're hoping.
We're sure hoping, yeah.
Yeah, we're hoping. We got a great show and a great first guest that's lined up. Rochelle Lawyer is our guest for the first podcast.
And you've known Rochelle for quite a while, right?
Oh, yeah. I've known her for a number of years. And right now, she's the Vice President for Innovation and Product Management for G4S America. And she leads this innovation team within G4S as well, focusing on enterprise security risk management. And this is something that Rochelle and I have shared for a lot of years, is the approach that we're both taking for looking at security and security risk. But in her career, she's managed programs in corporate security organizations focused on risk management. And she's responsible also for designing and developing resilience programs and looking at things from both a cyber and physical perspective. And the one thing I like just to get it in before we move on is that back in 2017, she released a book called The Manager's Guide to Simple, Strategic, Service-Oriented Business Continuity. My favorite, though, is she's the co-author of the 2018 book Enterprise Security Risk Management Concepts and Applications. And she serves on the Cybersecurity Advisory Board for SIA and the IT Security Community, ESRM, and the Crisis Management Steering Committees for ASES International. Just a phenomenal talent and such a great wealth of knowledge on enterprise security risk management and the whole principle of design thinking.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the design thinking, so much so that I not only did a little Googling, I got something up on the website as well. So for anybody that wants to get up to speed after the fact, check out caffeinatedrisk.com, where you're going to find this blog and a whole bunch of other ones, as well as links to many of the books that we mention in the show and upcoming guests, all that kind of stuff.
You betcha. And because we had so much, such great content in this first podcast with Rochelle, we're going to have an encore session with Rochelle later on this year, so stay tuned to the website and to our feed for the podcast, and you can catch out the second episode with Rochelle. So on that note, welcome again to our first podcast, and let's get into the session with Rochelle Lawyer from G4S Americas.
Having caffeinated risk just because caffeine's like the best drug ever, is that...
That was my vote, yeah.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Well, we spent some time on the name, so it got me thinking about how often you're staying up late, worried about things that are actually not even your accountability, and somehow they've found their way onto your desk.
Yeah.
Well, how do you push that back up to where it belongs and, you know, remain gainfully employed? Because there are ways that it's not my problem turns into, well, I'll tell the new guy then.
Yeah.
That's also not the answer we're looking for, so...
Well, I mean, this kind of that goes directly to the conversation that we had earlier last week about, are you passing the buck? Or,
yeah.
Well, no, you're not passing the buck. You're putting the who should stay up late on the right person who should be staying up late worried about something.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they're not worried about it, how does it trickle down to you for you to worry about it? Because it's their asset. If they don't care, why am I staying up late worrying about it? So,
and I think that was the key, right? And that was that whole transitional moment for some of these folks, at least over the years, was for them to realize, oh, you mean I actually have to do my job as a business owner? Yes, you actually have to do that, because this is one of the things that was concerning for me over the years, is if you're asking me to sign off on the risk, then the answer is no. So you're not going to have an iPhone or an iPad. I'm not going to give you a computer. You're going to have a notepad and a crayon. Come back to me when you're done every day, and then I'm going to put it away in the safe because I don't trust you to take it home.
Yeah.
So that's my level of risk, and that's my acceptance of risk. And I remember doing that at Bell Canada when Doug and I first got together, was that, yeah, so if you're asking me to approve it, no. But what? Yeah, you asked. No, this is my opinion. And if I've got the authority, if you've just granted me the authority to stop a multi-million dollar project for the Olympics, perfect. It's no.
All right.
All right. So digging into human-centered design, you'd mentioned controls a few times. Was that designing the intended effect of the controls that could actually be consumed, or was this more abstract, a sort of what do we want our organizational governance to be kind of design conversations?
So to be honest with you, it's both, actually. Where I have moved in this space is taking the design thinking and actually sort of doubling down on it, of making it a human-centered control. You want, because how are you going to get people to engage in your security program if they find it alienating and wrong and it doesn't fit them? How are you going to get people to engage with you as a security practitioner if you don't understand the human side of it? And when we were first starting this journey, say a decade ago, talking about being part of the business, being a partner to the business, we'd get these questions all the time about how do I do that? And can you human? Do you remember? How to be a human? And if you just put that kind of at the middle of everything, it really works. And so we're starting to take that in my organization as the end all be all of what does this do for the people who are interacting with it? Why do you want to mitigate this in this way? Why do you want to put this in place in this way? Why are you acting in this way? And okay, there are some things that can't be human-centered. Some camera is just a camera. But right. If you're going to design a program and you're going to put something in place, using that customer first. If you're in programming, you're talking about the user experience. We call it the person experience because right. It's everyone. But it's our employees, it's our security people, it's our executives, it's our customers, it's everybody who has to flow through the program. What is their experience? What is their customer journey looking like? And that to me is one of the big advantages that I found marrying the two sort of career paths that I've been on in the past 7 or 8 years of security, but I'm lucky enough to be on the innovation side of things and marrying the risk conversation with the innovation conversation with the human-centered design thinking has really brought out this ability to explain risk and value to people in a whole new way and get that engagement and build those relationships and understand how much security is dependent on your soft skills. It is important to be able to hang a camera appropriately, but to be able to understand and explain what appropriate means, mm-hmm. I think is where some of this industry needs to go and where we help, where that risk conversation really helps. So
Rochelle, do you think it can scale? Do you think that approach can scale now inside an enterprise or inside a larger organization where you've got so many stakeholders that a security team typically functions with every day? Do you think that's a scalable approach?
I think it's more important at scale, to be honest with you. If I only have to please two people, I don't have to go to a lot of effort to please two people. If I have to create a program that covers a broad demographic, that has to engage a lot of people, that has to have conflict resolution between competing forces, that I have to please both the asset owner who is trying to protect against, I like to say, intrusion, and I have to please the public-facing, I should be able to get into that location person, especially if we're talking about, heavily regulated nuclear sites. Yeah, it's a lot easier to not please the people who can't get in. But if I'm looking at any kind of place with a lobby, mm-hmm. How do you design for both sides to be happy? If you're not looking at large populations and engaging in the interest of large populations and understanding the psychology of mobs and groups and all of this, I think you're going to have a harder time designing a really well-functioning program. So to me, it's even more important to take that lesson to scale than it is to have it on a one building basis.
I like that. I like that whole concept. It goes beyond, you know, the typical. And I think what you bring up as a really cool approach is this: how do you scale to the human factor and not just keep pushing out the same message we saw the year before, or talking about the same concepts that we read in other areas? It's how do you get to that scale? And I like that approach. I like that human-centric approach.
Well, I tell you, like, I have been reading more about psychology lately than security. Mm-hmm. And it's all tied together because, I mean, every security problem is, well, not everyone, but the vast majority of security problems are human problems. And so for me, really gaining an understanding of the dynamics of human behavior, of why people are reacting in the way they're reacting, I used to just shake my head about, why would you do that? Like, yeah. Why would you literally do that? And understanding a little bit more about the motivations of why people might choose to try to evade my security program, I think also helps with designing things that are better and help mitigate that. So to me, it all goes back to the partnership that you can build, what you can learn about your people from HR, what you can learn about the culture that you're trying to engage in through the people who are responsible, like health and safety, all of these partner programs that have to be together, as opposed to competing for resources, you know, partner. I love working with marketing. Like, having marketing on my side is one of the best things that's ever happened to me in my security career. Being able to talk to them about how things resonate, branding the security as we roll it out, all of those things, and it just comes back to the people, and all people, process, technology, all of the pieces are important. But I'm just really kind of hammering right now in my career on the people aspect of it, the risk aspect. And I think maybe it's no secret, like, we've had a lot of, COVID has brought forward a lot of human related problems that mm-hmm. that are driving that conversation, and so driving the focus of why would you do that?
Because I'm bored. So now, quick question for you. You'd mentioned innovation a couple times, and if you're innovating, is there a thought around how you would design user interfaces in the future that are, well, they're secure, they're solid, but you don't need to do something like 3 logins and a blood test just to get on and do something?
Yes. the answer is yes. So it's really interesting, and I'm kind of glad you bring it up. It's this consumerization of the security space that should be happening, and I feel is not happening fast enough. Partially, we have to be careful because it's super easy to put out an internet connected toothbrush and not worry too much about the threat behind that. Like, what is going to happen if your toothbrush is hacked? Well, mm-hmm. All right. So we have to be a little bit more careful, but there are so many things that I can control directly from my phone in my real life. Mm-hmm. So in the house that I'm in, it's not my car, but there's a Tesla parked in the garage. There is nothing you cannot do to that car from your phone, up to and including if I'm at the door of the grocery store and it's parked out in the parking lot, I can make it come get me. That's awesome.
That is consumerism.
And it freaks the people out who are watching the empty car drive through the parking lot. But that's consumerization. That's the experience that people expect. That is what, if you are giving me a reader on my phone that's going to get me into my building, or if you are saying we have a visitor management system that that you have to register a visitor in, but then it's gonna magically escort them from here to there. It should function the way we expect our personal devices to function, mm-hmm. which is a heavy lift for people in the IT mm-hmm. security because the way that we get those personal devices to function is by giving them a leeway and giving them giving them risk. But that's where the future has to be. We can't make security hard. I cannot make it super difficult for you to engage in my process because you're not going to. You're going to find a workaround. You're going if it's easy for you to wave your phone or have your phone on you and the door magically lets you in, I have just stopped piggybacking as a problem for security. If I have developed an interface that allows you to seamlessly move through it, and everything that I do on my personal device is what I want my entire experience to be. I do not want to have to come to work and all of a sudden now I've got all of these flags and steps and everything. And you're right, I don't mind doing an extra step or two. I do have dual factor authentication on almost all of my personal stuff because because I'm in security. Like I know not everybody does it, but so I've got three on here, and I don't mind if I'm using a new computer that I have to spend several days re-authenticating to everything that I've ever done. And I think I'd be fine with that in a corporate environment too, but every single day for the rest of my life, I should have to do this just because security at work can't get itself to be as easy as security at home?
It seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? Because you've actually got a controlled space there.
Yeah.
I mean, they control the endpoint you're using, the building you're in.
Yep.
But what I should say, and I think is something that as an industry and as corporate security people and as identifying this risk to our executives, why is it easy for my phone manufacturer to give me all the bells and whistles? Well, because I have no problem paying $700-$900 for a phone. And people will do it every year. And nobody is going to pay that much for a reader. Nobody is going to pay that much for a piece of security because why? Well, we want this experience to be great. Well, do we?
Yeah.
So this is a constant battle in the innovation space in security. It makes it kind of fun, like because I get to have these conversations, but it is difficult to meet the price points of ease and safety. And so, you know, your triangle, you're always giving something up. I think it's a fact of life that as we get faster and faster computers and more an AI and machine, like it's going to come. It is going to come. We're not early adopters security.
No. I mean, we say we are, we try to be, but
unless it's a drone.
Yeah. Unless it's a drone.
In which case, we're all over it.
Or a really cool robot that can dance, like choreographed dancing. Then we're all over that stuff. Right?
Yeah.
So I got to ask though, I mean, it's, you know, there's this point that we're kind of focusing on and we're talking about and we're asking our guests about is this idea of diminishing returns. And I think you kind of struck it is from our perspective when we're identifying risks and you really brought up this idea of once I bring the human element into it. And now let's use that example as my personal life, I expect to spend that kind of money for a phone. I expect to have that kind of features and functionality from the phone that I have, and it's going to serve multi-purposes. Yet when we look at risks inside the corporate world or the world that we're all within, when do we start seeing that diminishing return? And how do you convince yourself and your stakeholders we're there now? We can be better at this.
Math.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's a good point. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, there's a I'm not a huge fan of strictly running things on return on investment, but that diminishing return, what am I protecting? What is the value to this company of what I am protecting? And is it worth my time, effort, expense to protect it in a certain way?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's not a hard, you can tie, here's the number, here's the value of your asset. While I'm having this conversation with you, I want you to understand the value of your employees' happiness, which, hey, bring, has anybody ever thought to ask HR for a metric of what it costs to turn over an employee who leaves because
yep.
they dislike the environment that they're in? Add that to your metric. That's part yep. of the protective value. So the diminishing return really is that what is the company's margin that they're willing to accept on loss versus expense and all of that. It's simple math,
mm-hmm.
but it has to be then tied to a story because the numbers don't tell the entire story. And this, I think, is a balance that not everybody gets right all the time. And Tim, we've had a million conversations about how to write a report.
We have.
And yep. how do you put exactly the right amount of number, solid math, personality,
mm-hmm.
and story? You got to mix anecdotes with math. I don't think there is a magic formula for it, but if you know your audience, though, if you know your audience and you've bothered to get to know them, you're going to know what's going to resonate with them. And so let me drag it right back to having a relationship with your business partners. If you know your audience, then you write to your audience. And that's who defines that diminishing return, because it's not us.
Yeah.
We can give them the information.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there may be some things where zero is the only acceptable answer. And, you know, some parts of a nuclear power plant, that
yeah.
would be a pretty clear case yep. for that risk tolerance.
Sure.
Yep.
You'd mentioned the term asset, and I'm wondering, mentally I have a model that includes everything that a system does is part of the asset. Whereas often when you look at the hard cost of replacing a server or even a software package, it's in the thousands of dollars. But if it enables $10,000 a day worth of business or savings and it doesn't work for a month,
yeah,
that's a $250,000 touch, which is a very different conversation than, you know, we need a new server.
Yeah. So, A, I actually try not to use the word asset anymore, which is, I should have been more mindful of that. I like to ask the question, what do we have to protect? Like, what are we protecting?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But so, because that gives you, it gives you the impression that you're protecting a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere in the organization, fingers crossed, you have some sort of system that tells you what is required to run this, and what is the value that it brings. And this, way back in the day when I used to do business continuity risk registers, you'd have to kind of dig into the dirt to get that.
Yep.
And it depends on how much you need to prove the point of what is this worth. We have found over time, I found over time, when I go to a person who runs the business and I say, what do you have to protect? They know. Like my very, very first business continuity job, I went in with a 400 question questionnaire. They had to answer all these questions. They had to provide all these numbers. Ugh. And later
yeah.
when I learned better,
yeah.
you just go and you're like, what is the thing that's going to stop you from getting your mission accomplished? And they know. Like, and if you have to quantify it, then you start quantifying that thing. And I will caveat this, no, not in the financially regulated sector. I'm sorry. You guys are never going to get away from the 400 questions because you're a financial institution and you're regulated. But the vast majority of unregulated organizations can totally get away with what is most important to you, and the business owner knows it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you build from there. And I mean, I hate to make it sound like such a casual approach, but we operate in a value system, when you're trying to define value and what value you bring and what the security department can do for the organization, it really is at that level of, what do you have to protect? How can I help you protect it? Like, I know what you need to protect it from if you point out to me what you got. Like, that's my expertise. I'll tell you, if you tell me what's important, I'll tell you what's after it, and I'll tell you how to stop what's after it. And we can do all this in a very nice conversational way. And then I'm going to explain to you what the risks are. And I'm going to say, hey, you can put this in place to fix it. It's going to cost you this. You can put that in place to fix it. It's going to cost you that. And when I give you this and that numbers, you're going to have a reaction as to whether which of those numbers is worth it to you. Mm-hmm. And that's how people, I mean, that's how business functions. So, you know, embrace that if you can. Right. It doesn't all have to be very nitty gritty.
No, I agree, Rochelle.
Right up until the second that you have a law that says it does. So I caveat that all the time because I know people love to push back. The second you say it doesn't have to be that complicated, they're like, well, in my industry. Okay. If it doesn't work for you, then continue with your 8,000 line spreadsheet because that's the only thing that works in there.
No, this was awesome. I mean, it's refreshing to hear the human aspect because we don't hear it enough. Like we just don't. And I'll be honest, I really like the idea of how could you get the profession to start looking at the human element, providing that level of humanity to the work that we do. I think that's where we're going to see growth in the next 5 years or more. It isn't,
absolutely,
don't get me wrong, that technical skill set, the ability to break into a system or reverse engineer a problem or, you know, execute the right control to reduce the malware and the ransomware. That's just going to be table stakes. That isn't going to go away. It's the level above now is how do I deal with the humans? Because everything we do is got a human element, whether it's on the keyboard, walking in the door, bringing in a package, trying to talk to the executives, giving a presentation.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense or if that, well, what do you folks think?
It's the drum that I'm beating right now. Like I think that enough people have grasped this concept that you have to manage risk appropriately, that the conversation has moved on to, okay, how do I accomplish this? All right, well, now let's start to talk about the next thing. How do you design this? It's a very flow charty kind of thing. You talk to people, you understand them, you grasp their problem, you come to them with a question about what job do they need to get done, not here's a solution for you that I don't even know what your problem is. And that to me is the next phase of this ESRM journey that the industry is on. I am starting to hear enough people define risk management appropriately. I don't care if they know what the actual acronym stands for. I've moved beyond the acronym, but like they get what it is to take a risk management approach. Great. Now let's talk about that next level of how we engage, how we do that, who we are as we're doing it, and what that brings to the industry, what it brings to our organizations, what it brings to us and our well-being, so that we're no longer, to the point of the name of your show, up at 2 a.m. with a giant mug of coffee worrying about something because we've taken it all on ourselves and we haven't shared it with the business. So I think to me that's where all of this needs to go now is building those skills in our organization so people can do that.
Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining
us. This is great conversation with you guys. I had an excellent time.
No, thank you. This was terrific. Thanks so much for your time. And as we work through this and we build up our little podcast, we're going to try to get you back again, if that's okay.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I love to talk.
Thanks for listening to Caffeinated Risk. Next time, we're going to talk to Wynn Schwarto. His most recent book is Analog Network Security. Tune in next time. We're going to talk to Wynn about risk and time. Thanks so much.